We have
portals to me. Are kind of
welcome to the committee.
Wasn't yeah. much of the time as it was.
Okay. Hey, next time we need a gavel and a.
Yeah.
Is that not on the committee card?
Yeah.
You're doing something, but
on the table. Don't need a gavel.
Well, we got to be so very precise and formal
she's
in this committee.
Committee
yeah, you're brand new to the committee and you're complaining already. I got enough already without you.
Thank you.
Years and years decided
ago. Just sign it and I'll take it.
Call the Commerce Committee to order. We have two bills on the agenda today and one, I think, Senate File 138. We're just going to get started on that one. There will be a lot of discussion on that bill even after it's we hear about it today. But I'd like to welcome Senator Fischbach to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Member, and you said you were on this committee once before?
Not this committee, but when you chaired.
You weren't that lucky.
No, when you chaired, what was it, state government?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I was on your committee then. You don't remember?
Cheryl, I'll never forget you.
It might have been my first committee meeting ever, Senator.
Yeah. We have a very distinguished attorney at the end of the Bobby Joe champion. Welcome to the committee. And we all like to kind of participate here. And we think it's a committee that's, well, I don't know if I should say this, but it's kind of a nonpartisan committee. And we try to get along and get things done and move the ball forward. And I think I have a little bit of a reputation, so that doesn't mean we can't get partisan once in a while, but Senator Latz, but and we do. But anyway, we have two bills today. Senator Latz, would you like to start us off with Senate File 227, Debt Collection Buyers Regulation? Senator Latz, you may proceed. And apparently, Senator Latz, I think somebody said it has to go to finance. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr.
Money
Chairman.
Coming in, money going out. So we'll deal with that later. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to be able to open in that nonpartisan vein that you referred to with Senate File 227. This is a bill. You may recall a couple of years ago we passed legislation to regulate the collection of debt in Minnesota, specifically the industry, the debt collectors. There were many concerns about at least some in the industry that had been using unfair, inappropriate, heavy-handed tactics, illegal tactics in some cases, to collect the debt. There was one major portion of that industry that was left unregulated, and this bill addresses that portion. It's those who buy the debt and then attempt to collect on it for themselves. So, you know, the larger portion of the industry that we addressed before were the third-party debt collectors. They didn't actually own the debt themselves. And by the way, this is the personal consumer kind of debt, credit card debt, that kind of debt. Those who purchased the debt were not covered by this, yet in their business is essentially to collect on that debt, and there have been complaints and concerns about them using the same kind of tactics to collect the debt. Some would say it's bullying or other kinds of tactics. And I'm not going to go into the list here unless there's someone who wants to hear some of those stories again about what inappropriate tactics have been used. But I will say that the Department of Commerce has informed me that of all the areas of business that they do not regulate in Minnesota, this area that we're attempting to regulate with this bill has the highest number of complaints in the Commerce Department. And I guess that's not surprising, since it's really, to the consumer, it's the same issue. The debt's trying to be collected. And there were abuses in the system before, and we came to accommodation with the industry as well in the previous bills, and we'd like to do the same here. This bill that you have before you then simply expands the definition that is covered in statute for regulation by the Department of Commerce to include debt buyers that are collecting debt for their own purposes. And it does so The way it's drafted right now, there's some new language in there, but I'm going to offer an amendment that will adopt the federal language so there is no confusion, so there's good clarity among the industry as to who is covered, and there's a history of regulatory law, case law, if you will, administrative law, that explains that definition. In support of the bill and of this particular amendment, I'd ask the committee to hear Prentice Cox, an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota, who is particularly specialized in consumer law and in the debt collection industry as well.
This is the A1 conformity.
That's correct, Mr.
Chairman. Okay, we'll hear briefly from Mr. Cox. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to have some minor oral edits to the A1 amendment so it fits the language of the bill properly.
Welcome, Professor. Identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Prentice Cox. I'm Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School, also former manager of the Consumer Enforcement Division at the Attorney General's Office. I will just briefly talk about what the debt buying industry is and the scope and problems that occur in that industry. In 2013, the Federal Trade Commission did an exhaustive study in which they examined approximately 5,000 portfolios of debt buyers, and it constituted $140-something billion worth of debt just in those portfolios. This is an incredibly large industry. The debt that exists in these portfolios is primarily consumer credit card debt, and it also includes debt from health services as well as the second largest component of that debt. This is not debt that has, that's collected by a third-party collector. Rather, it's almost exclusively accounts that have been charged off. So there, it's debt that the original creditor has determined cannot be collected. And it's packaged into these it's packaged into these portfolios is what they're called, debt buyer portfolios, and they're sold. And what's important to understand about this is when that debt is sold, all that gets sold in the vast majority of cases is a disk. Literally just a disk. It's a computer disk. And on that computer disk is not much more than the name of the person that is the alleged debtor, the amount of the debt, the interest that is accruing on that debt, and in some cases, but not all, who the original creditor is and the nature of the debt. It's a very thin amount of information that's sold. The second important part to understand about the industry is that these disks and portions of these disks are sold and resold throughout the industry. So a debt buyer will buy it, work on it for a while, and then sell it off to somebody else. One of the problems that occurs is that more than one version of this disk is sold, and so it's a common consumer complaint that even after they pay, that another debt collector calls them and they can't shake the debt at all. A perhaps bigger problem is the fact that because these are very thin files, often they're old debt. In fact, a percentage of this debt a fairly substantial percentage of this debt is usually beyond the limitations period for the collector, which is why it's sold. The cost, just to give you a sense of the average cost for purchasing this kind of debt and therefore the validity problems that exist in this debt, the average cost is 4 cents in the FTC study. So these debt buyers are buying these accounts to collect on them at 4 cents on the dollar. So the idea is that whatever they can get is pretty much going to be profit on this deal. The underlying problem is that the information about the credit is often wrong. In fact, when these debts are sold, what the FTC study found, which is consistent with my personal experience in handling cases like this, is that when the contract between the creditor or the debt buyer selling it to another debt buyer and the purchasing debt buyer contains a specific disclaimer of representations and warranties about the validity of the debt. So the debt they're buying, they've been given a contractual statement that there's no warranty or representation that this is valid debt, but they go out and collect on it anyway. In fact, the FTC study found a fairly high problem with the validity of the debt. In fact, consumer complaints about the debt are high because these debt buyers collect on accounts that the consumers either didn't have, it's the wrong person, or they've already paid. And because of the nature of this industry, which is different than other industries, the nature of the industry, that makes it almost inevitable that you're going to get these kinds of complaints. I could tell you a little more about it, but that's the fundamental problem. Because this is a different kind of very low-quality debt for which there's absolutely no guarantee of validity. One other point I'll make. So say you're the consumer and you challenge, which approximately 5%, maybe somewhere a little less than that of consumers do, which is fairly high, actually challenge the validity of this debt. And you say, well, show me the contract, right? Because you may be challenged the validity of the debt. You may be challenged the fact that you're being charged 18 or 20% interest when you think it should be 5% or whatever, whatever your complaint is. Say, show me the original contract. How do you have proof? How do I know you own this so that if I pay you, I know I'm paying the creditor? And the answer is, again, not only are they told in the contracts where they buy the debt that there's no representation warranties on the validity, but after a certain period of time, often 6 months, they don't even have the right to have access to the underlying documents. So they can't establish what the contract is. They don't know what the interest rate is. All they can do is say, we think you owe this, and then aggressively take people to court. That's the underlying problem. Real quickly, the legal situation is that Minnesota law, federal law has two primary categories for defining who a debt collector is. One is that it's the principal purpose of your business is to collect a debt. So whether you own it or somebody else owns it, the principal purpose to collect a debt. And the second is you're a third-party collector. You're collecting for somebody else. Minnesota state law only includes the second category. So federal law already incorporates a definition of who a debt collector is that brings debt buyers within the scope of the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, but Minnesota state law does not have an equivalent provision.
So, thank Professor, you. Your last remarks, I think, pertain to the amendment. Is that correct, the A1 amendment with the federal conformity? Am I kind of right there, Professor? In other words, I think what we're going to do is put the amendment on right now. And I thought you touched on it, but if you want to touch on the amendment any further, Senator or Professor, you may. But
yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Federal, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just note that the language in the original bill defined the debt buyers that would be covered by this. And Professor Cox recommended that rather than using that language, that instead we use the language that's already in the federal law,
okay,
because it'll be more clear and understandable, and there's already a history of its application.
Okay. Did you wish, Senator, to add a couple words to this amendment? Did you
I'm going to ask counsel to
The counsel will explain the changes going to be made here.
Mr. Chairman, members, this language is intended to replace what's in the bill, not add to it, which is the way it's drafted. So the first thing we need to do is strike all the new language in the bill as it is. And then on the amendment itself, on line 1.2, instead of page 1, line 14 after the period, it'd be page 1, line 11. And on line 1.4 of the amendment, instead of page 1, line 22, would be page 1, line 18. And the effect of that is just merely to replace this new language in the amendment with the new language that was in the bill.
Okay, any questions on that change?
Mr. Chairman, I adopt.
Senator Latz will offer that amendment. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Matching prevails. I notice you have a couple more witnesses, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, they're available to answer questions. I have the Commerce Department representative and the Attorney General's office is here. They're both in support of the bill, and they're available if there are any questions from the committee.
Let me ask you, Senator Pratt, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Cox, you referenced federal law. My question would be around preemption.
How do we determine whether federal law preempts state law or the need for a change in state law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, this because there's no private right of action in the Chapter 332 state debt collection law, this would allow the public entities, the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General, to enforce state law, whereas now they do not have a right to enforce any law regarding debt collectors because the FDCPA, the federal law, doesn't have an authorization for state enforcement, as many federal laws do. So preemption doesn't, it's a great question. Preemption does, as I tell my students, good question, but you're wrong. Preemption doesn't really affect this. It's just adding a state enforcement mechanism. Now, I will say, what's important about the state law is that it incorporates a violation of the federal law as a violation of the state law. So by adding this changing, increasing the scope of the state law, allowing this public enforcement, you also are allowing public enforcement at a state level of federal violations as well.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Chair, I just need that clarification.
Thank you. Senator Brown, did you have
a question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is either for you, Senator Latz, or Professor Cox. But I just have a question on the language. In line 1.6 of the existing language, it says any person. And then what we just adopted on Amendment A1, if we look at the original amendment, line 1.2 also says any person, but then line 1.4 says a person. So I'm just wondering if there's any significance between using the language any in some instances and a person, which seems to be more limited in another area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, the language in the A1 amendment is taken directly out of federal law. And so the intent there, which we believe is the applicable and appropriate scope here, there have been, you know, administrative actions and other case law interpreting the federal law. And so this brings with it not only the benefit of conforming with federal law, but the interpretations that apply. There's a body of law that regulators and those who are regulated can turn to understand exactly its scope.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Brown.
Well, thank you, Senator Latz, but I guess I'm just curious. To me, when I read it, any person seems to be more broad, and then when you say a person, that seems to be very limited. Would as an attorney, am I reading that correctly?
Sure that there's a distinction in the interpretation of that. Counsel might have something to add to it, but as a practical matter, I'm not sure there's any distinction.
Mr. Chair, members, the definition of collector deals with the actual people who work for the collection agencies, and so I think it is appropriate to use the term a person there. And Senator Brown, if you look at the original language as defined on line 1.16, collector is a person, so we're using parallel language there, so I think it works.
Okay. Well, thank you. It doesn't answer my question, but thank you.
Mr. Rick Whitty, are you here? Peter? I've been kind of a stickler for years on this idea of every time we ask the department to do something, we need 3.5 more people, or 7.5, or 6.18, or... And my question to you, and I know this is going to finance, but I see where it needs 3.5 more people. How many people are in the Commerce Department?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. A pleasure to be with you yet again. The Commerce Department is the fourth smallest agency in the executive enterprise.
That's probably not the question, but
approximately 340 employees. And certainly, as Senator Latz previously indicated, we are supportive of this bill and very appreciative of his willingness to work with us on the fiscal note. I think generally here, as he mentioned, we do not currently regulate or license this business area.
You don't, couldn't train anybody that's in the Commerce Department today to probably handle this?
Mr. Chairman, I think we probably will, but I think you're also talking about an expansion into a world that had previously not been regulated at all. And so I think we have some costs associated with making sure that we have the appropriate staffing to be able to adequately enforce the law and be able to take the enforcement actions, as Professor Cox was.
Let me start off by saying I'm totally in agreement with what we're doing here.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
It has to be looked at. It has to be regulated. But that's people that know me around here know that I make that speech 5 times a year, and we ask the department to do something. How many people do you have in administration? 1,300. Mm-hmm. Now you need 4.2 more? Yeah. Well, I don't. That's my story.
We're going to move it to finance, and then it's out of my control. But I
thank you, Mr.
have
Chairman.
To kind of give that speech every once in a while. Senator Lantz, I think any further discussion from the committee members on this? And I totally support the bill. But Senator Lantz, did you wish to make a motion then?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 227 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate Finance Committee. Okay.
On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. So, thank you, Senator Lantz.
Thank you, ma'am.
Senator Bonnet, I see you're off to my left somewhere. I mentioned earlier that we're just going to get this Senate File 138 started. There's a lot more discussion that's going to be needed on this legislation, and Senator Bonnet is aware of that, but this is a starting point, and we're not going to take action on it today. Senator Bonnet, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as I listened to Senator Lantz at the end with his motion to move to the to Senate Finance, I was a little envious. I knew that the prognosis would not be the same for the bill that I will be presenting. But yet, I do think it's important that we understand while there are issues to be worked out on this bill, it's really a great opportunity for the committee to hear it, understand it, and I hope, you know, have a productive discussion, because I think that the legislation that I'm bringing before you today holds great promise for our state and for the people in our state in terms of moving us forward with regard to our ability to spur on new, small, innovative business. So with that, we're talking about equity crowdfunding. I was introduced to this concept by Zach Robbins, who's a constituent of mine. Zach called me up and said, you know, hey, we've got this idea. I think you might be interested. What do you think? And he shared the notion that you could have small, independent people become investors in an online marketplace. And as soon as he was talking about this, I thought about my own personal experience with this type of investing, and I thought of two things. Number one, I thought of how the millennial generation is so much different than us in terms of how they think about finance, manage their finances. My kids somehow have bank accounts where they're really money market accounts, and they take checks and take pictures of them, and then they're deposited. And I still am confused by that. I don't get to do that at my bank, but I know they do things differently, and they think of themselves as very financially savvy and informed. So that's one thing in the back of my mind. Then I thought about my experience with raising money on the internet, putting aside our political experience with raising money on the internet. And I thought of a situation where where we have our cabin, my next door neighbor owns a store called The Comet, and that's it's both a movie theater and a store, and her film that she used was the old-fashioned 16-millimeter film, and she needed to move towards digital or the Comet was going to close. And so she needed $68,000 in order to transition to digital film, did not have that. Literally, the timing was such that she needed to raise it in a month. She put it out on Kickstarter and more than raised that instantly from around the country. And that showed me that there's an appetite for investing on the internet. But the funny thing is, in her situation, nobody got anything from that other than a T-shirt that she gave them. They didn't have a chance to partake in equity of the Comet. So this idea is different than that. This idea says, and by the way, it's not just our good idea. This is happening around the country, and I'll let my testifiers go into that. But this idea says, in fact, that you can pool money by individuals to support a person, cause, or business, and that you, in essence, are then able to have an equity stake in that. And so the bill lays out the parameters of that. The bill would allow equity crowdfunding for non-accredited investors. Currently, they can do this if they're accredited. So they have a certain net worth. They're allowed to do this. But the average person right now is not able to do this. We would be adopting intrastate rules if this bill were to pass that would allow Minnesota companies to take advantage of this only. It would be limited to Minnesota because for it to be interstate commerce, the SEC would have had to adopt rules for interstate commerce, and that has not yet happened. And again, I'll allow my testifiers to go through that. So I will at this point turn it over to them, but just wanted you to understand in concept that as we look at how tough it is, and we hear about the valley of death when we have emerging, small, innovative, high-tech companies, and they start and then they have trouble accessing capital, or we talk about our desire to make sure that Minnesota remains a mecca for high-tech investment. This is one tool in our toolbox to be able to allow these companies to have broader access to capital in a way that lets more people be part of the success and take ownership. So with that, I'd like to introduce my two testifiers at the table with me, Ryan Chilcrat, Zach Robbins, whoever wants to begin, sure. Go for it. Ryan.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Senate Commerce Committee. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Senator Bonnell. Thank you for the introduction. As she mentioned, my name is Ryan Chilcrat. I am a business attorney and a shareholder at Winthrop & Weinstein in Minneapolis. I'm doing this completely pro bono because it's an issue that I think helps my small business clients, so I'm not here on behalf of any client of the firm or any sort of other.
You don't get your $800 an hour.
Exactly, yeah, no, it's completely pro bono. Right, right. So in my role as an attorney who works with entrepreneurs and small emerging businesses every day, I have firsthand exposure to the challenges they face. And the number one challenge is how do they access capital? They can go to banks, they can get money, but there's only so much they can get. And ultimately, unless they have a network of wealthy friends and family, they need to find third-party investors. So when I meet with these investors and explain to them the rules involved in trying to do that and how they go out and find investors, they're genuinely shocked that the laws actually prohibit them from advertising the fact that they're trying to raise money for their business. Similarly, we think the regular Minnesotans are interested in supporting local businesses by investing in them, but the laws make it very hard, if not practically impossible, for them to learn about companies that are seeking investors. How do we know this? As Senator Bonoff mentioned, there's something going on right now called donation-based crowdfunding with her example of the Comet. It's going around all over town. There's a company just in the news last week, a little restaurant in Minneapolis called Bandbox Diner that was about to shut down, but they posted on a crowdfunding website that they need capital, and they were able to raise a couple thousand dollars to keep their business afloat. Minnesota actually ranks number 3 in the country for donation-based crowdfunding. So I think there really is an appetite of Minnesotans to support local businesses. So the bottom line is every day we meet with entrepreneurs and emerging businesses that have great ideas and solid business plans, but they need investment to turn those plans into reality. And we also know that there are billions of dollars sitting on the sidelines ready to invest in the next generation of great Minnesota companies. The problem is that our laws make it very difficult, if not unnecessarily challenging or practically impossible, for these companies and investors to find each other. So Congress, I would say, can't really agree on anything, even agreed that this was a problem that needed to be fixed. In 2012, they passed the Jobs Act and directed the SEC to come up with rules that would allow small businesses to use the internet to connect with potential investors. They gave the SEC 270 days to release rules. So far, we're almost to 1,000 days, and we still do not have any final rules. So in response, individual states, including our neighbors in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the Midwest, like Indiana, Michigan, throughout the country, states like Texas, Washington, Oregon, 14 states in all, in the last few months, have passed their own interstate rules, and it's currently in the legislative process in about 15 other states. I learned about this because I do a lot of work with our emerging craft beer industry in Minnesota. I work with probably 15 brewers and have helped them raise money to build all these new breweries all over town that everyone loves going to. It generally has taken people months, if not a year, to raise the money they need because they're pounding the pavement, talking to people. It'll also be done in secrecy to keep it private. Alternatively, I think if they were able to post these offerings on the internet and use the internet to find people who might want to invest, the process would go much faster, it would be more cost-effective for them, and it would ultimately be more transparent. It was my experience in the beer industry that led me kind of to this issue, because I attended a national beer conference last year where I spoke on a panel about raising money for breweries and how breweries can come up with their financing plans. And I met a gentleman from Wisconsin who had informed me that Wisconsin had just passed their own law that would allow breweries in Wisconsin to go online and raise money from potential investors in Wisconsin. So I came back from the conference, started talking to my colleague Zach Robbins here and other people at our firm, other people in the business community, about whether there was any movement in place in Minnesota to do something similar to what was happening in Wisconsin and around the country. After a few conversations, we quickly learned that there really wasn't anything going on. And Zach and I say we were young enough and dumb enough to think that we would write a law and try to get the problem fixed. So with that, I'll turn it over to Zach, and he's going to give you a little bit of an update on what we've been doing over the last 9 months.
Mr. Roberts, good to see you again. We met here a couple months ago, I believe. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Senators. For the record, Zach Robbins. I am a colleague of Ryan's, and I'm also here on a pro bono basis. We feel that this is a very important issue for the businesses within this state, and I thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here. I just wanted to follow up on what Ryan had to say. I'll try to be brief. For the past 9 months, we have been meeting with different trade groups, businesses, other interested parties within the state to see how important of an issue this is. And in fact, it is something that many different groups would like to get behind. I wanted to identify some of the groups that are backing us, many of which have representatives who are in this room today. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Life Science Alley, the Minnesota High Tech Association, Mojo, ACG Minnesota, which stands for Association for Corporate Growth, the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, Small Business Minnesota, Social Enterprise Alliance, the Metropolitan Independent Business Association, Minnesota TIE, the Black Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Bankers Association, and I could continue. All of our supporters are listed and identified on our webpage, minvest.org, M-N-V-E-S-T. I bring up these names because they represent groups from all across the spectrum. We are very proud of the fact that this is one of the very rare bipartisan issues that affects businesses and individuals all across the state. I did want to identify one stat. The Kauffman Foundation has identified that 96% of all private capital raised for businesses across the country goes to white males. We believe that this bill will essentially democratize the investment process, will bring in many different groups, women, ethnic groups, who typically have not had the ability to raise capital. And by accessing the other 97% of the population, which are termed as non-accredited investors, you will see, if this bill passes, that companies across the state will be able to raise capital from individuals within the community, within their city, within their county, for businesses that might just be restaurants or coffee shops, all the way up to high-tech companies that could grow nationwide. We also feel that this bill will be just as beneficial, if not more so, for greater Minnesota than just the Twin Cities itself. If you're in the Twin Cities, even though it's a challenge to try to raise capital from angel investors, you can probably do so if you pick up the phone and you know a handful of people. The further outstate that you go, the more likely it is, rather unlikely it is, to find angel investors who have been investing in young startup companies. This is where we feel that this bill could be extremely powerful. Three additional points that I wanted to highlight. We have also met with the State Bar Association Securities Division and received excellent feedback from a group of about a dozen securities attorneys. We have implemented all of the changes within our bill. The next point that I wanted to make is that we've also met with the Department of Commerce. We look forward to working with them, and we have a meeting on Friday set up with Peter. So we are very excited to work with the Department of Commerce on this issue. Lastly, just wanted to identify that this bill has sailed through state houses across the country. It's legal in 14 states so far. The closest vote that we like to state was 98-2. Thank you. I will pass it off back to Senator Bonner.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I would like the will of the committee. I can either go through the details of the bill, or I have two other testifiers, one from a company from outstate Minnesota who would like to talk about why it's relevant, and also from somebody who's been involved in the portal concept and is a Minnesota business.
Why don't we hear from your witnesses? We like to hear the folks.
Very good.
Yeah, let's do that first.
So, Mr. Comer and Mr. Berzonsi.
Let me just say, you talk about the bipartisanship. I believe that Senator Brandon Peterson carried this identical bill, Senate
yes.
Bill 204.
Yeah.
Not
right now. He has the same bill, and I actually
also
thought he was going to be here with me. I was surprised not to see him.
Oh, he's got it now, this year.
Okay,
but anyway, that's
okay.
The way you do have.
Yep.
The guy wasn't telling us a story when he said it was bipartisan, because Senator
that's right. Senator Peterson has his own bill,
okay.
And he's a co-author of this bill.
All right, I just want to make
yep.
that clear.
Thank
welcome,
you.
Gentlemen, and whoever wants to speak.
Thank you, Senator Bonner.
Yeah.
My name is Steve Comer. The program says that it's Connor, it's Comer, so just connect the ends.
C-O-M-E.
Good. Just brief introduction, over 60 years in Minnetonka, living and raising three daughters. Went to the University of Minnesota, played a little baseball there, and that afforded me a chance to play 12 years of professional baseball. It's during that time that I invested in a startup company called Metromark, and just recently in 2009 sold it after 28 years of success. After that, I met with a young lady that worked for me, and she started Alumilite. So now I am a co-founder of a startup called Alumilite, and we manufacture electroluminescent lighting for signage, backlighting signage, and other products. I'm here to talk about the pleasure of seeking money when you don't have it. Unfortunately, my baseball career did not lead me to the Twins, otherwise I would have been at the Polad's door, but what we did is we ended up meeting in about 2010, end of 2010, and started to formulate a plan. So we started to invest our own money. We invested over $100,000 in our money. We talked to the necessary accountants and attorneys to get a business together. And at that time, we felt that it was important for us to raise about $500,000 to get our products to production. So we went to area banks as a startup and formulated a plan with them that would they be willing to match our raise of whatever we did with friends and family, and then use the collateral that we were going to buy equipment and inventory for. We had three area banks that said that'd be reasonable. So we ended up raising $250,000 from friends and family, went to the banks. The banks declined us and said that it didn't fit their portfolio for a startup. So they said, come back in 2 years when you have 2 years of financials and hopefully with a profit. So from that point, then we went on to a leasing company, and we got them to authorize lending us $90,000 on the collateral of $225,000 worth of equipment. That helped us survive a little bit longer as we were moving forward and creating our products. From there, we ended up going into the Angel Network and the Minnesota Angels, the Twin City Angels, Angel Pollination. And we got certified. Our business plan and our business was certified, and we continued on and did about 12, 15 presentations around the state, up in Fergus Falls, Willmar, the metro area, and also in Owatonna. We didn't reach too much success in the beginning because the economy was just starting to recover. So a lot of investors were taking care of the businesses that weren't performing very well. We also weren't in the healthcare or med device or technical information industry. We're a manufacturer of products that go into a company such as a Target store or somebody like that. So then the third thing was is that the amount of money that we were seeking didn't fit a lot of the investment banks' portfolios. We were too small. So Angel Network, finally, we came to a meeting in Owatonna and met some people from Austin, Minnesota. The community of Austin and believed in our product and put together a proposal for about $450,000. We met with them, and when we got down to Austin and moved into a facility, we found that one of the entities that was lending money backed out. And so we ended up, instead of 450 of the 500 we needed, we had 300. So if you see a trend here is that we're kind of underfinanced all the way along the way. So as we did that, as we were in our facility getting ourselves to production area, we developed an award-winning product called the Uplight, which is a retractable display that is pulled up and is fully lit. We took that to a show in 2013 and was awarded the product of the year. We took that to crowdfunding, Kickstarter. Again, we put our proposal together and video, and we were denied access to Kickfunder because, again, we were outside the norm of what Kickstarter was basically supporting. And as you heard, the restaurant was a Kickstarter or something similar to that, and then also the movie theater is more of a that I think is more of where their avenue goes. So now we're sitting in Austin and we're underfunded, and so now we go back to family and friends, and we've kind of have no more family and friends to talk to. But at this time we also were certified for the Angel Tax Credit. And in 2014, we spent multiple times, during this whole period, we talked to strategic investment partners all over the country, not only in Minnesota, but all over the country, in trying to find somebody that would support us that is maybe a printer or a distributor or a manufacturer of a like product. And we continued to talk to, if not hundreds of these individuals, trying to find a way to raise money for our products and our belief. So as we did that, we ended up having our product at a show and ended up getting $1.6 million in orders. Mm-hmm. We're underfunded, so we can't produce the orders. So now we go back to the banks, and the banks say, well, we can't support you because your personal finances are now not up to par. So it's kind of a circle here that now we are in the process of going to financial institutions that will factor either on a purchase order or on an invoice or something like that. And there, if we were to raise $200,000, we probably would get maybe $140,000 based on their percentages. And now we also are starting to enter into crowdfunding that's out there now for more corporations, which is equity net or fundable. And so we're now in that phase of doing that. So I'm here to give you testimony. It's kind of tough if you don't have rich relatives or rich connections to start a company. But when you have an award-winning product and other products that people want to buy, we just need to find the money. So when we heard about this, we thought it would be a great opportunity for us to tell our story. And we appreciate you allowing me to do this. We're simply a company that's got a good product, and we want to grow in Minnesota. We are in contact with companies or potential investment in Iowa, Wisconsin, and South Dakota. I'm 60 years at Minnetonka. I want to be in Minnesota. So we hope that you can find it, that this bill is something that could benefit people like me, and there's thousands of us in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Koner. Senator Reiner.
Do we have one more testifier? I don't have a question, so if we have another testifier, I'll wait.
We do have some more if you want to. Okay. Very go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Joseph Barazanzi. I moved to Minnesota to go to Gustavus and never left. I run a company called Community Leader. We're based in Minnesota. We have offices around the country. We run the back office of portals. So in this legislation, there's a discussion of a MinVest portal. We have the software and service systems that run the compliance and the operation of the back office. We have over 60 clients around the country, and we have clients around the world and every continent as well. We don't have a portal in Antarctica, but the rest of them. we got involved in the crowdfunding industry 3.5 years ago because of the challenges of our clients and our friends and our family that had Steve's story. And we're here to help support this bill, as we have with multiple intrastate exemptions around the country, because I'd like to invest in Steve's company without him having to go to jail to accept my money. I'd like to pick up where Zach left off on the stats. There's lots of folks who can talk about how the private capital markets are broken, and we could have a long conversation about that. Zach's quote of the 96% of private capital goes to businesses owned and operated by white men. The Kauffman Foundation said the percentage that goes to women is so negligible, it's not even worth reporting. You go to the percentage that goes to white men, it's concentrated in Austin, Boston, New York, and Silicon Valley, and the rest of us are truly flyover country. So as companies grow and develop and they get ready to go into seed and Series A, B rounds of capital, unless they're very fortunate, they're moving their offices to one of those metropolitan areas. When we started growing our company, we expanded our technology team in Silicon Valley because that's where we were able to access the early stage capital. The SBA continues to report that the number one reason that the job producers, the small businesses, fail or are capped in their growth and capped in their job production is inability to access the right capital at the right time of the growth of their business. It's not because the banks aren't trying. It's not because there aren't angel investors. There's huge gaps in the continuum of funding. The reality is, with all due respect, this bill is not going to solve that problem. But this bill will give us one more tool. It will fix some glitches in the modernization of the market. Technically, you could do a lot of this today in today's legislation, but it would be in dark alleys, behind in secretive conversations, and that's how it happens. What this does is it modernizes it to bring it out into the open, to add a transparency, to add automation, and decrease the cost and increase the access to that system. When we talk about crowdfunding, I'm often talk about Minnesota has a long history of crowdfunding. There is nothing new that we're talking about. Minnesota Public Radio lives on crowdfunding. The grain elevators that we drive by all started because the farmers and the people in that community pooled their money to build that critical asset. But we've overregulated that space to tie out and make sure that 97, 98% of investors can no longer participate in those very type of projects. You couldn't build the grain elevators that way. You couldn't build a land of lakes that way. And that's what we are hoping to have an opportunity to help change. We can talk a long time about the issuers and how this system can work for businesses. One group we haven't talked about, which is equally worth lots of conversation, is about the investors and how this works for investors and how we protect investors, how we prevent against fraud, and how we make sure that people aren't scammed out of their money. We can talk about that a long time as well. My special expertise is in the portals. For these systems to work, there needs to be viable, transparent, regulated, but economically viable portals. In the bill, they're called the MinVest portals. These aren't websites. They're talked about as websites because that's the common phrase known, but there's a pretty sophisticated infrastructure of identity verification and qualifications of the investors and legal movement of the monies and OFAC checks and Patriot Act compliance and moving money into escrow and moving money out of escrow and doing that all in economically viable ways. Those intermediaries are the key to making these systems work. There's been a lot of states, give an example of one I know the best at the moment, which is Texas passed theirs, their last legislative session. People were excited. It was one of the biggest states to pass an intrastate crowdfunding exemption. The rules were brought online on October 22nd. Not a single portal's been approved yet. Of the 10 top portals in the queue, 9 of them are our clients. We met with the Board of Commerce there 2 weeks ago, and we believe our first, the first one will be approved, called Crude Funders. It provides an individual resident of Texas an opportunity to own a piece of an operating oil well. We could do the same thing with sugar beets here, or wind farms here, or solar, community solar farms. We could do that same type of thing here. What is making the difference in Texas to actually bring that one online is they're actually getting some exemptions from the bill the way it was originally written. What Zach and the team have done, with really great feedback from a lot of stakeholders in the community, is take what's been working and replicate that, but also polish it up so that we can actually bring a viable system online. Maybe we can jump ahead of our competitors that are attracting businesses across the border, because we really don't want you to have to move. So I can answer any questions about kind of the operations and how this actually gets implemented, and where in the bill the specific protections for both investors, issuers, have been put into place.
Thank you for your testimony. Did you have someone else? Let's see. I have Beth Cadoon.
That's really just Beth Cadoon is in the audience from the chamber, letting you know of her support, as well as Genevieve was here from Life Science Alley, and she's left a letter. So did you want to add anything?
Take some questions.
She's fine.
Oh, Peter.
I also have Peter Brickwoody on the list, if he would like to come and say a few words.
I'm sure I suspect my comments will take us in a slightly different direction, so I might defer to Senator Reinert or other members that have questions for the current set of testifiers before I make my remarks, if that's
fine. Anyone have any questions to the testifiers that have been here already? Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you. And just a couple of questions, one because I don't understand what the reason behind this, but on line 1.10 of the bill, it talks about the different Minnesota businesses that would be eligible. General partnerships are excluded. I'm assuming there's a reason for that. Could you tell me why?
Sure. Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Senator, the reason for that is with a general partnership, the partners would have unlimited liability for the debts of the business. And so just to prevent someone from unknowingly investing in a general partnership, they would be signing up for limitless liability. Okay. We excluded that from the type of business that would be eligible.
Right. And Madam Chair, one more.
Senator Brown.
If one of you could explain to me who would be eligible to, I don't know if you call it an owner, but to have a MinVest portal, who would be eligible to apply for that and operate that?
Yes, thank you,
Mr.
Madam Chair and Senator. Any company could apply to become a portal. The company would need to be authorized to do business in this state. The company itself wouldn't have to be headquartered in this state. What's most important here is that the investor and the company are both located within this state. The portal is facilitating the transaction, so they don't have to be physically located here. But there is a stringent list of items that the companies will have to fill out to apply to become a portal with the state. There's going to be ongoing record-keeping requirements with the state. There's going to be a fee paid to the Department of Commerce. Depending on whether or not the portal itself is a broker-dealer or is a non-broker-dealer, that will affect the compensation for the portals. If it is a non-broker-dealer, the portal and the agents, the employees within the portal, cannot accept transaction-based compensation. They cannot directly recommend any of the investments. That's the job of a broker-dealer, to make an investment suggestion.
And, Madam Chair, so they would need to be an incorporated business to own the MinVest
portal?
Senator, the company itself would have to be authorized to do business in this state, would not have to be incorporated in this state.
Yes,
and Madam Chair,
the portal, the portal itself would not. The issuer would.
Thank you.
The issuer is the company who is actually selling
actually right. in that company. The portal is the company that
website.
The website.
So would, Madam Chair, would that would a general partnership then be eligible to be a company that would be involved in that?
Mr. Schildkraut.
Or Mr. Robbins.
Oh, sorry. whoever.
Madam Chair, Senator, a general partnership from a, could create a portal. The liability of the portal written into the bill is limited to the amount of fees received from the issuers.
Thank
so
you.
We have limited okay. the liability of the portal. Very
thank
good question.
You.
And Madam Chair and
Senator Bonner.
Senator, because we didn't go through the bill per se, we've talked about it. Some of this is confusing. So I would just want to just to bring it down to its essence. We're talking about an issuer, a company, going out to the marketplace to raise money, and the portal is the vehicle by which the investors get to learn about it, read about it, the prospectus is placed online. So you've got, you know, your issuer is the company wanting to raise money. You've got your investor, which is the marketplace of unaccredited folks who with limits could invest, and then you've got your portal, which is this electronic interface. And so the one comment I want to make about the portal is there is some controversy, and you'll hear from the Department of Commerce, and there are even people sitting at this table who are concerned about the issuer being the portal. And so that is a discussion that will have to get worked out here.
Thank you, Senator Bonas. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to give you a heads up, if you're chairing for a lot longer, your cookie may be gone.
Oh, I found it under there.
Senator Lance and I have been looking at it.
I got
it disguised.
I was encouraging him to pass it around, but
not now.
Senator Bonhoff, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I'm a part-time teacher in a part-time legislator, which does not make for high-end investor. But I have a number of friends who have been involved in startup businesses in Duluth. I think it was Mr. Barazonzi, who mentioned a type of business. And add to that list craft brewers, micro distillers, homemade leather products, high-end medical products. All four of these are real examples in Duluth of people that were starting businesses and looking for startup funding, capital expansion to, sort of your example, hitting that first phase. We've got the sales, but we don't have the capacity. And as somebody brought up earlier, and I think this is a point I want to really emphasize, this problem is even more acute in greater Minnesota, where you have a community that may have a handful of people that qualify. I've seen the documents as a qualified investor. I mean, it's a significant bar of, net worth. You guys can speak to it, but it's six-figure assets and, thousands of dollars of cash on hand, and that's a very small number of people. But yet, when we think members in greater Minnesota, one of our big challenges is this transfer of wealth that's going on as generations move forward. And so this next generation of professionals and younger members in a community like mine have some assets, but they're not qualified investors.
Right.
And yet they want to help their friends and the people they know who have great ideas grow businesses in their own communities and literally are like, really, I can't put $10,000 in? No, you're not a qualified investor. That doesn't work. So I don't want to get into the portal land because I don't know enough about that. But, Senator, I'm a little remiss. We share an office, and had I known, I would have jumped on this a lot earlier because I really do think this is a critical issue, especially in greater Minnesota, and I've seen it in four specific businesses where and I would add, and I don't think this takes away from what you all were talking about, in every case I saw it as rounding out a package of financing. There was some bank financing available, or there were some investors, or there were some angel investors, but it wasn't quite enough. And so there was maybe a quarter or a third of the financing that they were trying to round out to get where they wanted to go, and that's where it would have been helpful to expand to this next level of smaller investor, a $10,000 or $20,000 stakeholder in the company. And I think we ought to make that change, and I think it would be very helpful. So thank you, Senator. And if you've got a spot left on the bill, I'd love to go on with you.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Reinert, given that Senator Peterson put in a clone. I bet there's some spots on that one. So thank you for your support, and I'll see what we can do.
Okay. Anyone have any further questions? Otherwise, we'll ask for Mr. Brickwitty to come and give his comments. And we did pass out a letter. You should have received it. That came from the Department of Commerce.
Madam Chair, again, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department. And first off, I want to say thank you to Senator Bonhoff and Chairman Metzen. We met with Senator Bonhoff last week, and as Mr. Robbins indicated, we're going to meet again on Friday. And really appreciate the willingness to discuss the bill and some of the concerns that the agency does have with the bill as introduced. Members should now have a copy of a letter from Commissioner Rothman. The letter also makes reference to a letter that NASA, the less exciting NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association, sent to NCSL last January on this issue as states were beginning to contemplate putting together their own intra-state exemptions. The department does have a number of serious concerns with the bill as it is introduced. I think, as Commissioner Rothman's letter indicates, that with some corrections, this presents a unique opportunity for us to strike a balance between having significant consumer protections and investor protections, making sure that Minnesota investors are protected with the exciting new area of raising community-based, socially-minded capital for Minnesota small businesses and startups here in the state. I'll go through the commissioner's the department's major concerns, which are outlined beginning on page 2 of the commissioner's letter, in a moment. But at a 30,000-foot level, they boil down to two categories. First and foremost, as the securities regulator in Minnesota, we have the responsibility at the Commerce Department to make sure that investors are adequately protected and that situations that could be fraudulent are not made readily available for Minnesota investors to be defrauded. I think thorough and proper protection from undue risk and a loss of investment is our number one priority. But balanced with that is our second set of concerns, which is making sure that we're protecting the very companies that we're aiming to help with this bill from inadvertent federal or state securities violations. And I'll get into that in just a second. Again, members, as I mentioned, beginning on page 2, we outline a series of major concerns, and I'll touch on them briefly. The first one, we believe that the offering and investment limits as in the bill as introduced are too high. They would be the highest in the country by a significant margin. The federal exemption conflicts is this issue where that I was just mentioning, where the small business itself may be placed at risk of SEC violations inadvertently. Senator Reinert, I completely agree with your comments. I think one of the situations we'd like to avoid is that if any of those businesses in Duluth were to inadvertently accept a donation from a resident of Superior, they would be violating SEC law, SEC regulation, and would be subject to federal penalties. And that's a situation that we potentially could involve or avoid. The state of Maine, which passed their own intrastate crowdfunding bill last year, has a model that helps avoid this conflict for small businesses. And so we've spoken to Senator Bonhoff about taking a look at that to try to avoid those situations. There was, Senator Brown, to your comments earlier, we also have concerns about issuers serving as portal operators. I think that also raises a number of significant concerns, both for investors but also for the small businesses. Folks who are, you know, looking to do a startup, you know, a brewery or other type of startup venture may not necessarily have the capacity or the understanding of what needs to be done in terms of protecting investor information that they would have to maintain if they serve as a portal operator. Having an intermediary who is a registered broker-dealer avoids that conflict entirely, and so we'd like to work on that in the bill. And Senator Bonhoff, we talked about that as well, and she mentioned it as well. We'd also like to see bad actor disqualifications. This was something that was talked about in the original concept over the interim, but is not in the bill as introduced. We think that if you would otherwise be prohibited from making a securities offering, either by state or federal regulations, that you shouldn't be able to do a crowdfunding venture. We think that investors should have proper recourse in the event that there's misconduct during the offering. I sort of touched on this earlier, but we have some concerns that the bill is silent with regard to the data practices treatment of investor data that would need to be maintained. And so I think that's a fairly easy fix, but we want to make sure that people's personal data is not placed at risk inadvertently, or that the small business that is making the offering is not charged with maintaining something that they would not otherwise be doing as part of the normal course of business. There are automatic inflationary increases in the amounts, which we already believe to be too high, so we'd like to speak about that. There is some limitations on our ability to examine the portals, which I think is a significant concern, and the resale restrictions for purchasers are something that we'd like to clarify. So clearly we have a number of major concerns, but I think the bottom line from our standpoint is we are excited to work with Senator Bonnoff to make sure that we get it right, because if we strike that balance, if we do it in the right way, we can present a really interesting opportunity for small businesses to be able to access community-based capital here in Minnesota, and we're committed to working through some of those issues. But as the bill is introduced right now, the department is opposed to it. I'm happy to stand for questions from members.
Any questions? Senator Bonnoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pratt, who hasn't yet spoken, given his expertise in the banking world, has also not only as a co-author, but has been sharing some thoughts and concerns with me. And so as we talk to the department, I have also asked Senator Pratt to be part of those conversations. And I don't know that we will be able to address all of the concerns of the department in a way that they'll put their stamp of approval on this bill, but I do respect their concerns and will do our very best to have resolution that Senator Pratt and hopefully the department agree with.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions for Mr. Brickwoody? Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Well, Senator Bonnoff did a great job of summarizing our conversations. I think what's important here is that when you're talking about business on the internet, it's a faceless transaction in many cases, and a lot of my concerns, I think, line up very well with the department. My question on Mr. Brickwoody, we hadn't touched on this, is you talked about limiting risk. And my question is, when you're talking about these types of investments, there is inherent risk in the transaction. And so how do you, without maybe going too far down the line, how do you protect the rights of the investor but still, recognizing that if the risk is properly disclosed, then they have the choice to accept it or not accept it.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, thanks for that question. And I think there are a number of ways where investor risk has been mitigated through the regulatory regime that has been in place in the country since the original passage of the Securities Act in 1933. I think the primary function of the disclosure requirements in any securities offering is to properly inform the investor of the content of the offering, who's doing the offering, and the potential risks that are involved. This is a new concept. You're quite right. This is primarily going to be an internet-based operation that can be faceless. And so there is some transparency there that needs to be included for the investor to know what they're potentially getting themselves into. I think particularly when you're talking about unaccredited investors, and we've heard a lot of discussion about that today, but the primary reason behind that division between accredited and non-accredited investors is a delineation accepted under an assumption that accredited investors can absorb the loss of their investment. Unaccredited investors, average middle-class Americans, potentially couldn't. And so you place individuals who have not previously been investing in large-scale equity offerings in a position to lose their entire investment and have that critically injure their ability to plan for their retirement or pay for their other financial needs. Again, that's something that should be up to the investor to be able to make that decision. So I think in terms of making sure that that risk is mitigated, the disclosures need to be accurate and comprehensive, and there needs to be a process for investors to be able to have recourse in the event that there was some sort of misconduct under state or federal regulation during the course of the offering, so that in the event, we hope that doesn't happen, but in the event that something goes haywire, that there is an ability to recoup some of their investment. And for the regulatory agency, the Commerce Department in this case, to be able to advocate on behalf of that investor in order to recover those investments.
Follow up, Senator Brett?
No, thank you.
Okay, Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like our committee has always had a great working relationship with Commerce, and I feel like this is an issue we can address moving forward. I would just maybe push back a little and say if we don't find a way to do something like this, we continue to concentrate wealth in the hands of a very small number of people. You know, we have a next group who is well-educated and professional and has some resources who's never going to grow that wealth if we can't find a way to lower that threshold for a qualified investor. So I look forward to working with the department on that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Reinert, I agree with you, and I think as you've heard, and the department would not disagree, that there is a challenge for small businesses to access capital in this sort of intermediary range. It's sort of a funny thing to wrap your mind around, that it's much easier to raise tens of millions of dollars in capital than it is to raise one or two. That said, doing it in a way that places both investors and the very companies that we're trying to help out at risk of significant state or federal penalties is not something that the department wants to see happen. And so we have to strike that balance, balancing the investor protections and making sure that people know what they're getting into and they're doing it in a knowledgeable way, with making sure that we're not putting the very people and businesses that we're trying to help at risk of penalties that they shouldn't step in just because they're trying to raise capital.
I think all of us at the beginning of this meeting, well, most of us, I believe, agree that something should get done. And when we started the meeting, I think I said something like, it's work in progress. And
right.
I agree with Senator Reinert and others that let's plow forward, work it out. Like I've said before in this committee, get out of here, work on it.
Right.
And the Commerce Committee and everybody concerned, get together and come back to us, and I'm sure it'll take a couple weeks or whatever, but we have time. But let's get something done in this area, that's my opinion, and but work it out and come back. So we have to be out of here at 1:30, so
yep,
that's why.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, and I think it's very healthy what we've been going through, but again, get it, work it out, and come back, okay?
Great.
Thank you. With that, we're not going to meet on Monday. On Tuesday afternoon, there's kind of it's not an official hearing, but we're going to go over to see Lemon Wells Distillery and the Summit Brewing company over in the old Hams. Is it the old Hams Brewery?
It's Tuesday.
This is a joint thing with the House. It's not mandatory, but it'd be kind of fun, I think, to see what they're doing. And on Wednesday, our committee will meet to start the discussion on Minshew, okay?
What time is that on Tuesday?
3:30. 3:30. We'll invite the local senator. That's not your
Summit. Where is it?
Summit?
Where are we going?
Summit Brewery in 11. The Summit or the
Summit's on West 7. Summit's on West 7.
Oh, is that where we're going to Summit? This one?
We're going to Summit
and the 11 Wells Distillery. Over in the old
Hampshire. Oh, it's at the Summit.
Oh, and that's at the Summit.
One's
two.
Beer and one's whiskey.
We've gone to Summit before.
Yeah, with Gerlach. When Gerlach was chair.
Yeah, we're going to do it again.
And
we're allowed samples.
I don't know that.
But with that, thank you, members, for your attention to this serious matter. With that, we're going to share in the cookie now. With that, the committee is adjourned.
Those making copies, distributing.